Inga Auerbacher is an author, a chemist, and a Holocaust survivor. Born in Germany, she was sent to the Terezin concentration camp in Czechoslovakia when she was 7. Out of 15,000 children, she was one of the approximately 1% who lived to tell the story. Auerbacher tells her story all over the world, always including the stark reminder that hatred still exists and must be dealt with. As part of National Tolerance Week, she comes to Vermilion next week, but we have her here on the phone from New York City. Inga, welcome to In the Moment.
Thank you so much. I'm very happy to come back to you.
Yes,
I do travel a great deal.
You have been here in South Dakota before. We're happy to welcome you back when you get off the plane there. And I'm wondering if we could go back to your childhood in Germany before, the night of broken glass and everything that sort of changed from then on. What do you remember about your childhood?
I remember everything. Actually, I've written 6 books. Mm-hmm. 3 of them are about my life. The most famous one is called I Am a Star, which is now in a new edition coming out very soon by Penguin. It's published 30 years already in print.
Wow.
So I'm very thrilled. And there's a play also on 2 of my books. What do I remember? I remember everything. I was born on December 31, 1934. In a little village called Kippenheim in southwestern Germany. And my family had lived there for at least 200 years.
Hmm.
We lived in the house where I was born about 100 years between my great-grandfather and grandparents, etc. We got along very well with everybody. My father was a soldier in World War I. And was wounded quite badly and received the Iron Cross. So we were extremely patriotic Germans. And when Kristallnacht happened, we couldn't believe it. When my father was taken to Dachau, my grandfather too, and he realized then, this is not going to be very good here, no matter how patriotic I am, and I almost gave my life for the country, it will not help at all.
So Kristallnacht, let's go back to that night. That's what I refer to as Night of Broken Glass. And before that moment, your Christian neighbors and you get along just fine, right?
We lived next to Christian people. We were a little bit more isolated. Yes, we had the Jewish community, 60 Jewish families among 2,000 inhabitants. Christians go to their church on Sunday, and we did it on Saturday. That is our Sabbath. And there were always some rumblings against the Jewish people. I wouldn't say it was totally none at all. We did get along very well. I mean, we considered ourselves German with the Jewish religion. We're not a race. We're a religion. That's very important to know because Hitler said we are a race. We're not. I mean, they're black-haired Jews. They're blonde. My mother was blonde. Different color eyes, whatever. Mm. I mean, we lived in Germany for more than 1,000 years. Jewish people came right after Jesus. You know, they followed the Romans into Germany. So it's not like we were there yesterday. It's just that the religion was Jewish.
Right.
That's it.
So
we're not a race.
That night, then, you remember it very well. We're talking November 9th.
It's called Kristallnacht, but it was a massive riot on November 9th and 10th in Germany and Austria. By us, it happened November 10th, actually early in the morning. My grandparents, who lived about 200 miles away, also in southwestern Germany, my grandfather, we were quite religious. We were modern Orthodox. Grandpa went to the synagogue in the morning to say his morning prayers, and he was arrested and sent to the Dachau concentration camp. Then the police came to the house, too, and arrested my father. He hadn't gone to the synagogue yet. All men and boys from the age of 16 between those 2 days were arrested and sent to concentration camps. In our area, it was Dachau, which was the first concentration camp in Germany. and other place was Buchenwald. Depends where you lived.
So do you you're six, seven years old at this time?
At that time, I was not even 4 years old.
You were not even four.
It was just before my fourth birthday. Mm. December 31 is my birthday, and this happened November 10th in Kippenheim. Almost all the synagogues throughout Germany and in Austria were either burned to the ground or desecrated very badly. In our case, there were Christian houses very nearby the synagogue, which, by the way, stood in the middle of the village. And they couldn't burn it down. They started, but they desecrated the inside very, very badly. All the windows in the Jewish houses were broken. I remember standing in the living room with my mother and grandmother, glass all over the floor, and I was just holding on to my mother, and one of the hoodlums saw that the chandelier was still hanging through a big rock through the broken window, and then we were hiding in the backyard shed. We had a large house, about 17 rooms with a courtyard, so we were hiding in the backyard in the shed.
Did you know them, the hoodlums? I mean, you saw their faces?
No, we didn't know them. In fact, you know, now in retrospect, when you ask who were they said, oh, they were from another town. I am sure there were some people who also went along from our village, too. Mm.
So you're hiding in the shed, and your father's gone.
Everybody's gone.
Yeah.
All in the boys and men from the age of 16 on were gone. Only women and children were left in the village. We really didn't know where they were sent to. Mm. No idea.
What happens next to you and your mother then?
Well, I mean, all the, we found shelter with our neighbors, and where all the windows were broken too. We had to pay for the damage. We boarded up the windows first. All the damage that they did, we had to pay for. All the windows had to be done again. And somehow, after a few weeks, they were permitted to come home again, but certainly in very bad shape. When they went to the camp, they had to give up all their clothing, wear those blue and white striped uniforms, stand at attention in the bitter cold. Dachau is very near Munich. It gets very cold at that time. And when you stand for hours and hours in the bitter cold, you know, you can get a cold, too. And if somebody wanted to blow their nose, there were holes down with ice-cold water. And that happened to my father a few times. And they told him, you can throw away your iron cross. It means nothing. And by the way, talking about how patriotic we were, I had a great-grandmother who had 14 children. She had four sons in World War I, and two gave their lives for Germany. Later on, quite a few of the others were killed by the Germans.
So your father comes back. He's been very badly treated.
And then we decided to sell the house, certainly at a reasonable price, and to just get out of the country. But all the doors to the free world were closing their doors very, very rapidly. My mother had already a brother and his wife in America, in New York, but he couldn't help us. It was, President Roosevelt just closed the doors to us. We had a number which would have taken maybe, who knows, 10 years to get here. Of course, my father didn't do it fast enough either to make the application, and he also had the problem with his right arm. And at that time, you know, you could not become a burden to the country here. Mm-hmm. Somebody had to vouch for you. It wasn't like it is today. You couldn't go to a hospital and, come and say, here I am. And so it was difficult for my father to get a high enough voucher to take care of us because he had that war injury. I mean, he could work. Right. He was a textile merchant. And we lived then with my grandparents 200 miles away, hoping still to get out. And actually in that village was called Jebenhausen. My hometown was Kippenheim. I will say in that village, there were only 1,000 people living there. At one time, it was 40% Jewish. But around 1850, they went to America or to have a better life. Except my family, they stayed. They were the only Jewish family in the village. And I will say that all the Christian children played with me. In fact, I just lost my first ever girlfriend, and we stayed friends for life. It's very sad. I lost her recently.
I'm sorry to hear
that.
And
they all played with me. I still have one other one who's still alive. When I go to Germany, I visit those people.
Right. Tell me, Inga, when you started, as you're playing with your Christian friends, when do you start having to wear the yellow star?
Oh, that comes much later.
Much later. When does that start, and how did you feel about that?
It started really in 41. I was 6 years old at that time, and school had to start. And I was not allowed to go to the school with my friends. There was only one Jewish school for the whole state of Württemberg, and that was in Stuttgart. And I had to get special permission papers to go there. In the beginning, my father took me first on a bicycle to the railway station, and because you could not take a bus, and then to take me by train, close to an hour. Later on, school stopped when the transports to what was called the East began. And so after 6 months, there was no more school. I never finished my first grade. I lost 8 years of schooling in my life altogether. Mm. And then the transports began. And at that time already, when I was going to school, we had to wear the yellow star, the badge, with the word Jude on it in Hebrew-like letters, was yellow, bright yellow. And by the way, we had to pay for those stars. Everything had to be paid for, everything. Even to go to the camp later on, they charged us. So the first transports from that area were, the first one was to Riga in Latvia. My grandfather had died just after Kristallnacht. He couldn't believe his beloved Germany had forsaken him. He had also been a soldier in World War I, by the way. Mm. And we were in that transport, as were almost all the children from my school. And my father wrote a plea to the Gestapo, the secret police, that he's a war veteran with the Iron Cross. And somehow luck prevailed, and we got out of that transport. But 6 months later, this was in 41 in December. In August, we had the papers again, and we had to go to the concentration camp in Czechoslovakia Terrace in North Dresdenstadt, which was, and I was the youngest in the transport of close to 1,200 people. At the end of 3 years, I was there between the age of 7 and 10. There were about 13 people left from that transport.
Wow.
That's what my mother told me, about 13.
So Terezin and the children, I know you have a personal memory of this.
My memory is good about everything.
One of my favorite books is by the great Maurice Sendak, and it's Brundabar with Tony Kushner. And
yes.
By the way,
I met him.
Did you?
And not only that, he wanted my books, I'm a Star and Beyond the Yellow Star.
I dedicated
the sequel to my teachers, who meant a lot to me, especially my science teacher, who introduced me to science, and I did become a chemist. And my first grade teacher, Rothschild, and was his name, and the other one was Ruckless. And he told me, Maurice told me, he spent a whole hour on the phone with me, and he said, I had Hyman Ruckless, too, as a teacher in a different school in Brooklyn. We were living in Brooklyn at that time, and I went to Bushwick High School. And he told me that he was failing science, and he said to me, if I draw some pictures for a book he was writing, he was the chairman of my department in science. He went to a different school. He was older than I am. And I will pass you in science, I think in physics or something. And so we had a really nice conversation together. I did meet him eventually.
So tell me about the children's opera, Brundabar, because I don't know that many people know that story.
Talked about.
Yeah.
It was done in Czech. Mm-hmm. It meant not that much to me. I never learned Czech, a few words here and there. It was mainly the Czech children who were part of that. Now, Terezin, was a transit place. It was a place that they put the intelligentsia of Europe, the best musicians, the best of everything, lawyers, doctors, to show the world, oh, we have them all in one place. We're not doing anything to them. But it was a place where you keep, like, cows or animals before the slaughter, and then you send them out. Because most of the people in Terezin were sent out to the killing centers. Mm-hmm. We were 140,000 people in Terezin, between 41 and 45. The first transports went there in 41, the end of 41. I came in August of 42. Altogether, out of those 140,000, two-thirds would be shipped out to the killing centers, mainly Auschwitz, and they, many of the times they brought them there, and perhaps after a few weeks or even the same day, they put them in the gas chambers. And then close to a third died there. Over 30,000 people died there of malnutrition and disease. I mean, I came out very sick with tuberculosis, which is also told in the play, by the way, that will be in the Orpheum Theater. And the story goes, I had two Holocausts in my life, surviving the camp. We were 15,000 children, and maybe 1% or so survived under the age of 15. It was my best friend over there, my bunkmate, did not make it. She never even made it to her 10th birthday. Her name was Ruth.
Ruth. So you had an awareness, even as a 7-8-year-old, that people were going to their deaths.
You didn't think about it. It was always called the East. And the East could be worse than what you had at that moment. It was bad enough, but you always thought it could still be worse. We didn't really, you know, they kept it from us. Mm. In fact, they made the people who went to Auschwitz to send back cards, it's nice here, join us. They had a special, I've been back to Terezin quite a few times, and I'm going again in August with a group. And even in Auschwitz, they had a special family camp called the Terezin Family Camp. They kept them there alive, some of them, for a little while, and they had to send back postcards, you know. Oh, it's wonderful here. Come and join us.
Wow.
And it was really just willy-nilly when the selections were made in Terezin. There was one last one, among the last, the disabled. I lived together with my parents in the what was called the disabled war veterans section. There were people, our fathers, who were, there were children there too. Very primitive, old, raggedy houses, run-down mice, bed bugs, rats and fleas. Those were our constant companions.
And what do you have to do during the day? What is your daily life like?
Well, my daily life, well, we were children.
Right.
So what did we do? We played around in the garbage dump, trying to find a potato peeling. You can still cut off a little bit. Hunger was constantly with us. It was always the idea of finding something to eat, because the food you got there was not enough. Hmm. You know, the rations. And no vegetable ever except turnips. And not enough of that, or potato, and a terrible-looking soup. Bread was a bread ration. So we were playing around in the garbage dump. A rotten turnip, for instance. You could always find a little piece. We never had any real meat. My father would find maybe some horse bones that they put in, you know, the meat from that. Slivers. I never saw a real piece of meat, never a piece of fruit, nothing.
What's
nothing.
The relationship with the guards like?
The guards were you know, you had two sets of guards. You had the Jewish ones, too, and at night you had curfew. I didn't meet any, there were SS men, too, for instance. Eichmann, who was in charge of the whole Jewish question, the final solution, to kill all the Jews. He came quite often, and I saw him there. He was, you could not look into their faces. You always had to stand and bow your head. But he did come quite a few times. Every time he came with their bright, shiny black cars, I remember those, you knew exactly there will be transports out to another place east, we called it.
Hmm. Did you know how they...
didn't come very close to us. Yeah.
Did you have any sense of who was being selected to go east, as you say, and who was not?
No, we did not.
It's random.
Totally random. The last selection of these, for instance, this group, sometimes there could be a group. It was just willy-nilly. He told them there was also a Jewish set up there, a camp elder, and Eichmann would say, I want 1,000 here this week, 1,000, 1,000, 1,000. And they had to draw up lists, and that's it, willy-nilly, and that's it. And there was a selection towards the end. In fact, the gas chambers were being built, by the way. They were not there, and they never functioned. They were not complete. But at the end, Eichmann ordered gas chambers to be built in Terezin, but they were never completed. He wanted to kill every last Jew still in Europe.
Mm.
And when the selection took place, our fathers had to go to the SS headquarters. And he went with my girlfriend's father, who was, by the way, half Jewish. He had a Christian mother and a Jewish father, but he married a totally Jewish woman, and they had one daughter exactly my age, 2 months older, Ruth. She was brought up as a devout Christian, not Jewish. And they went together. Their name was Abraham. I was Auerbacher, so they went according to the alphabet. Germans are always very precise alphabet. And when they came back, my father asked him, did you go to the lady with the typewriter? She put a red circle around our name. No, I didn't, and it meant death. We didn't know it. And to tell you the truth, I was very jealous of my girlfriend. When she went away, I said, oh, she's going to get out of this hellhole, and she's going to go on a train. And, of course, we didn't know anything. She had the same doll. The doll was always very important to both of us. I had a doll. She had a doll. Her mother made some little clothing from rags for her birthday. There was never anything to give for your birthday, a little potato cake the size of a mashed potato, the size of your children's palm. That was my birthday cake with just a hint of sugar. You know, we never got anything. So the
doll goes with her?
She gave me some of her doll's clothing, which I gave my doll to the Holocaust Museum in Washington.
Marlene, the doll.
Marlene. And Marlene was, actually, I found out later, my grandmother gave it to me when I was 2 years old. My mother loved movie stars. And, of course, I couldn't read anything yet. I was too young. And I saw a picture in the album that she had. And I said, who's that lady? You know, blonde-haired lady. My doll had also blonde hair in cellulose. It wasn't real hair. Yeah, that's Marlene Dietrich, and she was a very famous movie star at that time. So I said, I give her the name Marlene. And later on, I did find out when I speak in schools, I have a PowerPoint, I speak all over. In fact, I'm on my way now to New Zealand. Wow. I've been invited to speak at the Eucharistic Convention in New Zealand, too. And I'm going to Australia as well in just a few weeks from now, 2 weeks from now. And this lady in Germany, I speak a great deal in German. Last year was 4 times in Europe, including Rome, where I spoke. She said, that was a famous doll. I said, well, she was famous for me. She said, that doll was, her name was Inga, actually, the model. And this model was made for the 1936 Olympics. So we have a film on that, the Olympic doll.
Oh.
Yes, so it's really interesting. I never knew about that. That my grandmother, her only grandchild, she gave the doll, you know, with the name Inga. And I would like to say something about the righteous people who helped us. There were very few, and they are heroes to me. When I went to school, I still was going to school, you know, within those 6 months. My parents at that time, when my grandmother was deported, they threw us out of my grandparents' house and put us into a sort of a slummy area with only Jewish people living there. And I had to do slave labor. My father and my mother, she was sewing in the undergarment factory, and my father had to do the cutting. He never did that before. And I went by myself as a six-year-old child to school. Imagine, 6 years old. I see children today alone on the train, and we had to wear the yellow star. So my father always would say, sit in such a place that you can cover up your star, because there were some children who would heckle me, you dirty Jew, and so forth. It was very dangerous. I remember once there was a Christian woman who saw that little girl sitting there. And as she walked out, she put a brown paper bag next to my seat, probably her lunch, and with rolls in it, and she walked away. I never found that lady without any name, anonymous. Wherever I speak about this fantastic lady who wanted to do something, had more people wanted to do something, even in the face of danger. Maybe this horrible thing wouldn't have happened. My second hero is a woman, a very good friend of my grandmother. She was also her maid for many years. And she came in the middle of the night in the village, when we still lived in the village, in my grandparents' house, and picked up some of our photo albums, two photo albums, our prayer books, and a few religious things, candelabras, and a few things that she put in the basement, came in the middle of the night. She could have gotten killed for that. And she also put some food in the Jewish cemetery behind my grandfather's grave. She was a hero. When we came back from the camp, we said, we are going to see Teresa. They said, Teresa is no longer alive. What happened when the Americans came to that part of Germany? They knocked on the door. She didn't understand the English. She stood behind the door, and as he knocked, and she didn't, do anything. And the soldier got very anxious, and he thought maybe they would shoot up out at, from the windows or something. And he shot through the door, instantly killing her. And I say, if there's a heaven, there are two women walking side by side, a Jewish woman and a Christian woman, forever united. One was killed in the forest in Riga in a mass grave, and I saw those mass graves. The other, the product of war, and they are forever united. I'm still very good friends, even with their great, with her great-grandchildren.
Tell me.
So those are my two heroes.
Tell me what being liberated was like. Liberated by the Terezin's liberated by the Soviet Army,
yes,
in 1945.
We were liberated by the Soviet Army.
What is that like moment?
On May 8th, we were probably the last place to be liberated in 1945. The place was almost empty because they had been transported out in 44. By the way, there's something I don't know, you probably read about, that's very important to know. The International Red Cross came in 1944 to visit a camp. They were pushed to see a camp, so they made a complete deception in Terezin. They built a music gazebo, music orchestra was playing, signs to the school, to the playground, and this is when Brundibar was also shown to the International Red Cross Commission. Mm-hmm. And they made a film at that time, how wonderful it is there. Of course, it was a lie. Soon afterwards, all the people were sent to Auschwitz, and the camp was almost empty. So, and they gave a very good report. They didn't see beyond that deception what was really going on. That's why Terezin is called a showplace camp. Only the model camp, because of this International Red Cross inspection. And that was very short time when they painted the houses. Otherwise, many people died there and got sick. So it was, as I said, a holding area. Now, at the end of the war, there were these death marches coming in from all different camps who were still alive, because Eichmann still wanted to kill all of them. He was building the gas chambers. So I'm standing there waiting for, I heard the Riga people are coming. I said, oh, I will see Grandma. Of course, she had been killed years before that. And these people who were in terrible shape, terrible, marching for days and in open cars, open railroad cars, they told us, don't you know about Auschwitz? And we didn't know. They kept it from us. And on a few days before liberation, there were always, they called them latrine talks. We didn't have real bathrooms. You know, they were these, they were open, actually. The latrines had an open door in the winter, very cold, one for women, one for men. And by the way, hygiene was maybe two showers a year together with the women took the children, the men separate. And so it was very hard to keep clean, very difficult. So we called them latrine talks. They, you know, if somebody heard something, oh, we are being liberated soon. It was years before, you know, the stories grew as the people talked to each other. And so around the two, 3 days before liberation, you heard a lot of noise. The trucks were moving out. They were running away. Mm-hmm. I saw blackened piece of paper, burnt paper floating through the air. They were burning some of the documents. And I remember climbing up. We were surrounded by barbed wire and wooden fences. And Terezin was actually a little town, an army garrison town with brick brick barracks all around. So it was totally closed up little town. It had two parts, the big fortress and the smaller one, which served as a prison for the prison. That was an old prison from years ago. Has an interesting story, Terezin, built by Emperor Joseph II in the late 18th century. So I was climbing one of, I was kind of a real ghetto kid by then. By the way, Terezin was called a ghetto and a concentration. It served both.
Right.
You know, to hush it up, they called it a ghetto. Well, it was a concentration camp. So I climbed one of the wooden fences, and all of a sudden, as I did, I heard this big explosion. I thought my head had blown off. They were throwing hand grenades as they were fleeing into the camp, and people got killed.
Oh.
And then I went to my parents. My father had been an army veteran, so I said, we have to find shelter. They're going to kill us now. So we went into this dark hole, the cellar we never even knew existed, and one person had a tiny candle. I took one thing with me, a prayer book my father found in the garbage. It belonged to a former soldier who had been sent to Auschwitz. He threw it out. Either he didn't want to take it, or he didn't believe in God anymore. And I never prayed so hard in my life as I did on that day. We have a special prayer in Hebrew, like you Christians have the Our Father. Ours is called the Shema Yisrael, which is said a few times a day. And I never prayed so hard in my life. I never lost faith in my in God, never. And I'll sing it to you as just a second. Shema Yisrael, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad. Actually, you're not supposed to say God's name in vain, which is the Adonai. We say Adoshem, his name, when you're not praying.
Yeah.
And, of course, we have holidays coming up very soon, now Passover, and you have Easter.
Right.
So I do want to wish everybody a good holiday for Easter and for Passover.
Tell me, Inga, and if you're just tuning in, this is Inga Auerbacher with us. She's coming to Vermilion soon. And I'm wondering, you talked about heroes and you talked about righteousness and you talked about hatred being still present in the world today. So as you look around and travel the world, really, talking about your experiences at Terezin, your experiences in Germany, coming to America, what is the message that you're bringing to people now?
Well, the message is actually right here where I live, in Jamaica, Queens. I live, Queens is the most diverse, the borough of Queens in New York City is the most diverse in the whole country. I live in a row house for many years. My parents bought this house, and they're all attached. On one side, the walls touch a very devout Muslim family from Bangladesh, Muhammad and his family. On the other side is a very religious Hindu family from British Guyana. Now it's called Guyana, they're originally from India. Then there's a Christian house, and I'm Jewish. So we have four religions of the world living side by side, wall to wall, and we are good neighbors, and we can get along with each other. And as we must. And that is my message to the world, especially the Easter message for Passover and for Easter. we have to get to know each other. We have to stop being prejudiced against other people. We cannot be that. It look where it leads to. It leads to terror, to killing, to hatred, stereotyping. It is important to get to know somebody else who has a different religion, go to their church, become friends. And I think I have become a much more tolerant person because of my own experience. And I do live the way I speak. That is important. You can't just have empty rhetoric if you do not practice what you speak.
Inga Auerbacher is a Holocaust survivor. She's a chemist. She's an author of multiple books. She comes to Vermilion to speak at the University of South Dakota on Monday, April 3rd at 10 a.m. as part of National Tolerance Week. That's at Farber Hall. And then she's at the National Music Museum at 7 p.m. on Wednesday, April 5th for Music as Memory, A Child of the Holocaust Remembers in Song. Inga, come back anytime.
Also, there's the play in the Orpheum.
The play in the Orpheum.
The Star on My Heart. Very important.
I did not know about that. We'll make sure
Thursday night at the Orpheum, and it was written by Angela Miloro Hansen from Ohio. Wonderful play. It has been done in New York already and different places in Ohio, and I want to thank again Mr. and Mrs. Weiner for making all this possible. They are my heroes. Mm-hmm. And of course, all the people in the cast and the director, Benji, and John Mangan, and Mrs. Lindblatt, also, who helped us a lot. There's so many people, too many to mention. I am immensely, immensely grateful to all of them to making this, I hope, I know it will be a wonderful week of tolerance. Mm-hmm. And we have in Hebrew a wonderful word, shalom. It means hello, goodbye, and peace. Let us live with peace in a peaceful world together, side by side, heart to heart. That is so important, without hatred.
Shalom.
Shalom.